Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. 8:06 on this Friday. It's September 16th, 43 degrees. Currently in Old Town Park City, and on the phone with us from the ABC Forecast Center, meteorologist Nate Larson. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie. Yeah, happy Friday, folks. A lot of the moisture held off till overnight. Had some good rain up in Park City, about 0.2 inch being reported there in town. So not a lot, but still have a risk for some showers today. We'll call it partly cloudy. We're going to see some sunshine as well. Some scattered storms expected this afternoon. It's about a 40% chance. Highs will be near 64 on your Friday afternoon. Tomorrow, more moisture lingering. We have a weak low pressure system moving through northern Utah. About a 50% chance of some scattered showers and thunderstorms in the afternoon. It seems like most of the moisture is going to stay north of a lot of the Wasatch Range, though, mainly impacting the West Desert areas into southern Idaho, right along the Utah and Idaho state line. So I'm not expecting it to be a washout of a weekend by any means, but we still have a small threat of some storms. Sunday is going to turn nice and sunny. Temperatures will be near 68 on Saturday, 73 on Sunday. So we're warming up a little bit. Southwest flows increasing, a little bit breezy, even up in the mountain valleys. 74 on Monday, sunshine continuing. We have a trough of low pressure that's going to start to work its way towards Beehive State as we get into midweek next week. So we'll start to see increasing moisture in eastern Utah Tuesday. That throws Park City along the Wasatch back with just a slight chance Tuesday afternoon and evening of a thunderstorm. Highs will still be near 74. But then we've got a cool down coming with a front on Wednesday. Temperatures drop to near 66. And we're expecting showers and thunderstorms Wednesday and Thursday, with temperatures falling to about 61 on Thursday as well. Hope you guys have a great weekend. Leslie.
Okay, you too, Nate. Thank you.
Thanks.
KPCW News Time now, 8:08. Well, stay tuned. Coming up on the local news hour this morning, I'll be checking in with Park City Municipal Environmental Sustainability Project Manager Celia Peterson. She'll have details about the To-Go Container Pilot Program that opened for registration yesterday, as well as a preview of next week's Mountain Town 2030. Park City Councilmember Max Doyle in with a recap of both the meeting last night and the retreat on Wednesday. And finally, Park City Film Director Katie Wang calling in. She'll have a preview of some of this fall's films that I'll be screening at the Jim Santee Auditorium. KPCW News Time now, 8:08. KPCW News Time now, 8:09. Haven't yet heard from Laura Smith, so we'll get into some local news here. The Talking Tax Valuations Town Hall was held Wednesday at the Jim Santee Auditorium. It was a forum to question Republican candidates on Utah's tax policy. KPCW's Carolyn Murray was there and has this report.
The town hall wasn't advertised as a Republican campaign event, but rather a chance to discuss public concerns over this year's property tax increases. However, it was organized by the Summit County Republicans, and all speakers were Republican candidates for office. Holly McClure is running for Summit County Council seat D, and John Jack Murphy for seat E. District 26 State Senator Ron Winterton and Representative Mike Kohler were also present to answer questions. Those who commented were universally outraged by the increases in their tax bills and what they called the inequitable assessments on property values. In Summit and Wasatch counties and across the state, some property values increased in 2022, while others decreased. Some speakers called for county elected officials to be jailed and demanded immediate action from the Summit County Council. District 59 Representative Mike Kohler explained that the county council lacks the authority to fulfill their requests. He said the county must comply with Utah state tax laws, which require assessments on all properties every 5 years. That means 20% of properties are reassessed each year.
The real issue here is our assessments, coupled with the idea that our values have gone up so drastically in such a short period of time, leaving the assessors unable to get everybody up to that level. So that it can be fair. This doesn't have anything to do with the budgets. The budgets go up and down at various levels, but not very much.
Kohler said he wants to change tax law to give the state tax commission more leverage to adjust tax rates and valuations when market forces drastically drive up property values. He said some tax law changes would require a constitutional amendment. He also wants to limit the impacts such increases have on some older constituents.
Kara Brickland and a few others and myself are working working on a law that will probably protect older citizens, 65 and older, so that their homes can't be increased in value over a certain amount, hopefully protecting them from these drastic increases because many of them are on fixed income and have an inability to adjust.
About 10 people gave public comments on their tax bills. John Staffschultz said he's lived in Park City for 30 years and said his tax bill went up 40% this year. He asked for clarification on how full-time versus second homeowners are taxed.
Deer Valley second homeowners, which is most of it, if they became COVID refugees over the last 2 years, and we have an influx of that, then if they were dropped 45%, are we making up that amount of money?
He was referring to Utah tax policy that assesses second homeowners at a much higher rate than full-time residents. According to County Council member Roger Armstrong, calls for the County Council to invalidate tax assessments are not possible.
And we don't get to go outside that and say, okay, we think that because this is an unprecedented market rise year, that we should do it differently. That's not permitted. For those who are calling for the Summit County Council to invalidate this assessment, it's illegal for us to do it.
Tune in to KPCW's Local News Hour next Tuesday at 8 a.m. when Representative Mike Kohler will join Leslie Thatcher to discuss more details of the legislature's tax law initiatives. Carolyn Murray, KPCW News.
It's 8:13. Good morning. Well, the Park City Museum experienced a water leak on Thursday morning and was closed for the remainder of the day. The Park City Fire District responded to the leak about 8:30, which was caused by a malfunctioning pipe. Firefighters worked in conjunction with city officials to shut off the water to the museum and to remove as much as water as possible. No substantial damage was reported. The museum is expected to reopen this weekend after some cleanup and rehabilitation. Well, Park City is launching a new study for the proposed Arts and Culture District, and the City Council says that it wants to ask residents a basic question. Do you still want it? Park Amela Testa has more on that.
Park City locals have gone through years of debate and drama related to a section of the Bonanza Park neighborhood that city officials worked to turn into an arts and culture district at Kearns Boulevard and Bonanza Drive. The topic came up again during the Park City Council's retreat Wednesday. Some time has passed since the project was put on hold, and the city said it's time to check in with the public again. A previous study on the district was done in 2017, but plans were eventually scrapped amid community concerns with the price tag, which ballooned by 30% to over $100 million. But the space is still vacant and its central location offers possibilities, so the city is going back to the drawing board, conducting a new study to gauge public interest and explore what an arts district could look like and cost. Simultaneously, the city will start work on an area plan for the Bonanza Park and Snow Creek neighborhoods. Councilmember Max Doyle said the city and the world have changed a lot since the last study. He said what's important is that there's a long-term plan to carry the project into the future.
And how do we keep such a massive mission on the track moving forward with the changing dynamics of those of us who will be sitting here over the next couple of years? Because I think that's part of the frustration in the community is, you know, having to sort of reevaluate the same area over and over and come to a new conclusion each time sort of seems like a path to nowhere.
The Sundance Institute and the Kimball Arts Center would both be key partners in the project. Park City Mayor Nan Worrell said both support conducting the study. There are currently two large development applications in the same neighborhood, the city's Homestake Affordable Housing Project and the redevelopment of the Doubletree Hotel, commonly known as the Yarrow. Between those two, Park City could see the addition of nearly 400 housing units. At the retreat Wednesday, Councilmember Ryan Dickey said those pending applications point to possibly needing a building moratorium, which has been discussed in the past but never used.
Before those applications come in, we have to have a clear vision about what we're doing. And I want to go back to our development moratorium conversation at some point because I think it relates to that. We need to be able to actually hit a pause button so that we aren't dealing with development applications as we do this plan.
State property rights laws make enacting a moratorium a challenge. The city would have to show a compelling and countervailing public interest to put one in place, and it would only last a maximum of 6 months before needing to be renewed. In March, Park City Planning Director Gretchen Milliken told the council that the department considered requesting a moratorium in 2021, but planning staff eventually got through its backlog of applications. At the separate Park City Planning Commission meeting on Wednesday, Commissioner John Kenworthy also broached the topic of a building moratorium, but it wasn't discussed at length. After crafting a Bonanza Park Snow Creek neighborhood plan, the city will begin updating its general plan in 2023. The general plan is a guidebook for land use decisions and hasn't been updated since 2014. Parker Malatesta, KPCW News.
KPCW News Time now, 8:17. 8:17, good morning, I'm Leslie Thatcher. It's the KPCW Local News Hour. Well, Park City has launched a reusable to-go container pilot program. This is going to happen the month of October. In the studio to tell us more about it and how to register, I have Park City Environmental Sustainability Project Manager Celia Peterson. Good morning, Celia.
Good morning, Leslie.
So maybe what is this all about?
Well, as you know, waste is an issue, especially in Park City, so we're looking at piloting some circular economy solutions. So we partnered with Bold Reuse, Recycle Utah, and five local restaurants to try out a reusable to-go container program. Basically what it is participants in the program will sign up at boldreuse.com/parkcity, and anyone can go there to sign up to use the program during the month of October. And what it will get you is access to a reusable to-go container. So you can visit one of the five participating restaurants, I'll list them in a second, and take away a reusable to-go container. And rather than throwing it in the trash, which most you have to do with pretty much every single-use container, you can return it to one of the drop boxes. And then Bold Reuse will take that, clean it, sanitize it, redeliver it to the participating restaurants. And those containers can be used hundreds of times over and over again instead of ending up in the landfill.
So what are these containers made out of? I mean, they're BPA-free and...
Oh, yeah, mm-hmm. Of course. We did a sustainability life cycle assessment on different container types. It's actually stainless steel is the most environmentally friendly. If we're reusing it, that's really expensive for a pilot. The program is actually container type agnostic, so we're able to lease these containers from Bold Reuse, and then they'll take them back and recycle them or get them back into their system after we're done with the pilot. Obviously we want to continue, so they'll ideally they'll stay in circulation, and we'll build the program engaging more participants in restaurants, so it's a zero waste solution for sure.
Yeah, so is there some deposit then on the container so that if people don't return them?
Yes, so for the pilot program, we're using a subscription model, so participants go to boldreuse.com/parkcity and sign up to be part of the program. It's a $10 subscription fee for the month, and you can use the containers unlimited amounts. You've got access to two containers, so if you forget to bring one back, you still have one extra. But if you don't bring them back, then you're out of the program. You have to return the containers to get new ones. We're also talking about, and so that works really well for our locals that would like to take to-go food but don't want to be throwing the packaging waste away. What we're discussing, and they're piloting in the Portland area, is more deposit-based. So every meal you take, you add an extra $1.50 to the meal, and then when you return it, you get that money back. But we're not ready for that quite yet. We're piloting the subscription model. So basically, it's a one-time fee that participants pay, and then they can use the containers as much as they want for the month of October, as long as they return them in a timely manner after they're done.
Okay, so those drop-off locations are at the restaurants themselves or somewhere just...
Correct, at the restaurants themselves, mm-hmm. And then Recycle Utah, I have to mention that they've been a wonderful partner. There'll be one at the recycling center as well.
So there's some kind of scan code on them so that people know that this is my container.
Correct, yep. Yeah. I think one of the best things that came out of COVID was people getting used to using QR codes. So yeah, people will scan the QR code when they return the box, drop it in the box, and then they can have access at one of the restaurants.
Okay, and I'm guessing, I mean, this, for people who eat out a lot, I guess, you know, somebody who might eat out now and then, why would they do this?
Well, I think that it's it's a circular solution. So if you want to try something out like that, this is something that our community needs. And so just to be part of that, and also just to get rid of the guilt. I know I would love to, I get sick of cooking and would really love to just take out sometimes, but I'm not going to do it because I can't throw that stuff away. Takeout containers simply aren't recyclable.
Right. All right. So this $10 only pays for October. I mean, then is it 10 bucks every month or?
We're looking at what the pricing model is going to look like. $10 a month is basically what Bold Reuse is doing in other places, and it's working. But I think people will get sick of paying every month. So an annual subscription at a discounted rate, I think, will be suitable as well.
Mm-hmm. I mean, is there some way just to purchase the container and then... Right, and then just have that as a credit or something, or they've got to make money. That's why it's
right. Yeah, it's a subscription and deposit-based model that they're operating on, and of course, people can bring their own reusable containers. And there's probably some health code violations with that. Don't know exactly what that's all about. That's one barrier that I hear over and over again. But we've been talking with the health department and are staying close with them to make sure everything's copacetic as far as health and safety goes as well.
All right. So let's see. You had mentioned there was, about 5 restaurants, I think.
Yep.
And how did you select these restaurants?
These are the ones that stepped up to the plate. Mm-hmm. So I'll list them now. We've got on board Guest House, Salt Box, Este Pizza, Deer Valley Grocery Cafe. Savory Kitchen, we're actually testing out. They provide 50 meals per day to Soaring Wings Montessori. And Soaring Wings has been looking for a reusable container solution for years. So we're going to test this model out with... Savory Kitchen and Soaring Wings, and that's very scalable. That if it works, we can work with any other school to get rid of all the single-use waste that they produce when they're serving kids meals.
Okay, and again, you'd put out a RFP or something to them just to say, we're doing this, would you like to be part of it?
Well, one thing that anyone can do right now on the website, you can go to the very bottom of the website. If there's a restaurant that you would like to see added to the list, that's something that we're collecting feedback on. And yeah, well, I think that restaurants that want to be part of circular economy and zero waste solutions, they can come to us at this point rather than us coming to them.
Okay. You are capping it at just 150 users for October?
Correct. Yep. It's limited space. We got a grant from the EPA actually to pilot this. And so we're quite limited in how quickly we can scale at this point. And we thought it would be important to cap it to a certain number of restaurants and a certain number of users just while we iron out the kinks. So once we iron out the kinks, make sure that it's a usable system, everyone's happy with it, then we intend to go big. Actually, the co-founders of Bold Reuse are two women named Jocelyn Querrell and Heather Watkins, who actually has Utah roots. They will be here the week before we launch the program, and we'll be doing a lot of engagement with restaurants and some bigger venues as well, because it makes more, this definitely works better for the economic model at scale. But we got to make sure it works before we can go big.
Right. So what happens after October? I mean, then what? You decide whether or not it's something that it's worth following and pursuing?
Yeah, and I think so far so good is all I can say. I don't see any reason to stop the program after October at this point, but we haven't started using it yet. That October is the pilot. So we will learn a lot, and if we have to modify, pivot, and make it a better model, then this is our learning chance to do that. If it just flat out fails, we don't want to invest more money in it. I don't see that happening at all. I think it will be a positive problem of how do we make this work at a much larger scale quickly.
Well, that's what I was going to say. I mean, when I think of some of the takeouts that I do, I mean, they're not these restaurants. I mean, right, they're just more the fast food places. So, I mean, is that ever a reality that that would happen there?
I would love to see that happen, and I will work to make that happen, but it's up to the restaurants. We can't force them to participate at this point, but their customers can definitely let their opinion be known and have them get in touch.
All right. Meanwhile, you are off to Breckenridge, Colorado next week for the Mountain Town 2030 conference. I think this has been on COVID hiatus, since 2019?
Correct, yep. Breckenridge is site number two for Mountain Towns 2030, and there's a nice group of us carpooling over to Breckenridge next week.
All right, so what's happening there then?
Oh, Luke's actually been the point person at Mountain Towns. I've been busy with other things. Michael Mann actually is one of the people that is the keynote speakers, and that's a big draw for me to get there. He's one of the most renowned climate scientists. And then lots of workshops, lots of other staff and elected officials from other mountain towns, lots of networking and sessions around all things sustainability related in mountain towns.
Yeah. Again, this happened the first time in Park City. I think it
Correct.
Was kind of Park City's
Correct.
Effort, right?
Correct. Yes, it was a Park City initiative back in 2019, and it was the first time that all four major ski corporations were in the room together and talking about climate change, because we all love and know snow, and we can see with our own eyes that things are changing. And so just to preserve the snow that we all love was the driving force behind pulling together Mountain Towns 2030, but it's a very collective effort. There's been learning sessions in the meantime for city staff of communities that are engaged with Mountain Towns, and lots of great information from some of the nation's leading experts are just being delivered straight into sustainability and elected and executive staff from different mountain towns.
Yeah.
As
so
part of this effort, yeah.
Who else is going from Park City and Summit County?
Emily and Zach from the county sustainability team are both going. Morgan Mingle from the chamber's going. Joel and Andy from the community foundation. And I'm sure Luke obviously is going. I'm sure there's others that I don't even know about, but we've got a great gang headed over.
Yeah, I noticed that former Park City Mayor Andy Bierman is one of the opening speakers.
Absolutely,
just
yes, of course.
His interest,
he was one of the co-founders of this and a driving force behind the original initiative, so he's very important to Mountain Towns 2030.
All right, and as you mentioned, lots of breakout sessions. Was there anything in particular that you are planning to attend?
There's one on climate-friendly building code that I think will be really good. There's one on zero waste solutions in Mountain Towns I think will be really good. Honestly, I'm looking forward to the networking opportunities and just talking to people and see how things have been for them and their own communities for the last couple of years and what they're working on and what's working, what's not working, and how do we drive forward.
Okay, well, we'll talk to you again in October or November and just find out how this reusable container pilot goes.
Cool. Hopefully by then there'll be more restaurants and
all right,
it'll be thriving.
Anything else you want to mention?
No, have a great weekend. Thank you.
Thanks. Drive safe. That's Celia Peterson, Park City Municipal's Environmental Sustainability Project Manager. You're listening to the Local News Hour on KPCW. KPCW News Time now, 8:30. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. It's the KPCW Local News Hour. The Park City Council met twice this week, first in a day-long retreat on Wednesday, and then its meeting yesterday in the studio with a recap. Councilmember Max Dorelli, good morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
Let's start with the meeting last night. Council got an update from the Park City Ice Arena staff and briefly discussed that interlocal agreement with the Snyderville Basin Recreation District. Basin Rec doesn't want to go beyond their annual $50,000 contribution. And again, we've brought this up before, but using some cell phone data, the city found that nearly a quarter of the visitors to the Ice Arena reside in the 84098 zip code, 16% coming from Salt Lake City. Surprisingly, Park City 84060 representing only 7% of the users. So I guess what is the future of the Ice Arena look like in terms of kind of the management and cost sharing of that?
Yeah, that's actually a really good question, Leslie. We have been having these ongoing conversations with Basin Rec. The ice facility is 17 years old. We have an interlocal agreement with the county. We really didn't know where the ice facility was going to land until later in the process. It happened to land on city land, so the city sort of ended up with the management duties of that facility. forever, we've, well, since the beginning of the agreement, we've had 3-year reviews coming in just to sort of reevaluate whether that $50,000 contribution was the right contribution. Last night, I think our council was in unanimous agreement that that was sort of the only piece worth coming back and revisiting every 3 years, because in the process of managing it, we go in and get every bit of funding that we use from the Basin Rec approved by their board. So Basin Rec, they did not want to participate in the $275,000 request for capital improvements to keep the building up to the standard that we feel it should be. But they did agree to increasing their annual contribution to $66,000 with a couple requests in there. And I think we're still basically dealing with those requests, and we'll see kind of where it all shakes out.
Yeah, since it's a part of the enterprise fund, right, for recreation, I mean, do we need to then perhaps relook at, you know, everybody pays the same going in there. Do we need to relook at that to make sure that people who are using it are paying their fair share?
Yeah, you know, the whole conversation around fee differentials, it's a bit stickier. It's not a just do something to fix one little problem. We share so many resources with Basin Rec, and we just want to make sure that any conversations that go down that road are really vetted through, whether it be the RAB board or whatever the community organization is in the basin, to make sure that we are serving all of the residents of basically the entire region. Well, we have kids programs that we share, you know, in the fall, soccer is run by one group. In the spring, it's run by another. These things have all gone really well for a long time, and we don't want one little thing to kind of throw off the whole system.
So you did hear from the general manager of the Ice Arena saying that upgrades will be needed in the next 3 to 5 years. So how do we figure out who pays for those?
Well, currently, it's looking like the city is going to foot the bill for the time being. We are going to continue to work with Basin Rec to see if we can come to a little bit better resolution. But Park City's committed to keeping that ice facility operating. It's a heavily used facility. They operate 18 hours a day. They have kids in there early in the morning, dedicated figure skaters coming in as early as 5, and then the hockey, you know, men's league, for instance, is playing until midnight. So there's a lot of use out there, and we're not really interested in not having that facility be operating at its highest, you know, highest and best use.
Yeah. So what are we talking about in terms of monetary? I mean, the upgrades costing how much?
That's another good question. So the facility, most of the major pieces, elements to the facility, were meant to last between 15 and 20 years. They're deteriorating fast. We're 17 years in. We're starting to see some fall through the cracks. We do capital investments in there all the time. We're doing our best to kind of keep it together, but there are some big costs coming down the line, and I guess we're kind of holding our breath, seeing which one's going to come first. But those guys are on top of it, and they're doing everything they can to make sure that facility continues to operate at the level it is expected to.
All right. Council also considering the options for the nearly 40,000, I think, cubic yards of toxic soils there at the Gordo property there near the entrance of Park City on 248. The city council seemed to like the number 3 option, which basically would open up to redevelopment following a cleanup program like we did with the Old Town Transit Center. I think what we did there is that as we dug the soils, we then buried them and then built the transit center over it. You had said that the public shouldn't be surprised if there's some fugitive dust in the process. What is that? Should we be concerned?
I don't think we should be concerned. We had all the experts in the room for the first time in a long time, which is really nice. We got to ask them very direct questions about what we have to do, what we can do. I think we were in agreement, unanimous on the council again, about the redevelopment option as our best option out there at Gordo. It allows for us to mitigate the soil on site. Some of it will be trucked away, but the the point that I was making is that that soil is not mitigated properly right now. And the experts in the room made it very clear that we do have to mitigate that soil some way or another, so it does have to be disturbed. And that was a big part of our conversation during the election. People were concerned about the disturbing of that of those soils. We don't have a choice in that. It does have to be disturbed, whether it's just pushed into another deeper pit that's lined similar to the Old Town Transit Center, similar to Park City Heights, where they come in and they do, you know, there's a liner underneath, they cap it, they come in and do regular testing. That's the type of ongoing management of this site that we're going to have to do one way or the other. And we thought highest and best use, again, I'll use that term, highest and best use is to redevelop that area so that we can use it for some community good.
So anything in particular that makes sense to you to build out there?
I would, I have some ideas, but I would refrain from making any assumptions at this point. I really want to see what comes to us.
Yeah, it was kind of thrown out earlier this week, perhaps a park and ride, right? Gives you that right-hand turn. It would also be at the traffic signal, right, with Richardson Flat Road?
Yeah, that seems like a really good option. There are lots of different needs in the community, and I want to make sure that we vet all of those needs, so...
All right. When does the public input process start?
Honestly, we have to get to dealing with the soil first. I think it's a little bit too early to say.
All right. You also asked for the status of the Richardson Flat with regard to opening it up, I think, for city soils to be located there. The official from the State Department of Environmental Quality then deferred to the EPA. Was the EPA in the room?
The EPA was not in the room, but we have had regular contact with our EPA representatives in the region. We're assured that we've been, you know, pretty consistent about asking if we can get back into that Richardson Flats site. It seemed to me, and the feedback we got was that, you know, a decision on that is not pending and it's not coming in a timely fashion.
Yeah, well, we had seen for years lots of activity happening there, right? As we saw some of the soils being trucked over there. And then I think as we saw Talisker kind of leave the picture, who I believe is accepted the ultimate responsibility for that. Without them as part of the player, we don't know who's making the decisions here.
It's a really good point, Leslie. That's private property out there. That was another point that was made last night. There's also litigation happening on that land. So it just doesn't seem like anything's going to happen in a timely manner, and I don't think that that's going to serve our residents best to continue exploring that. We will continue putting the pressure on, but expecting that to change anytime soon was made abundantly clear that we should not.
Yeah, who made that decision that it would only be opened for, I think, like operating units 2 and 3 further downstream? Whose decision? The EPA's decision?
I would imagine it was the EPA's decision, but I was not on council when that decision was made, so I would have to refer back.
All right. Housing team presented a request for proposals for the Mine Bench property, and again, this is located in the location of a former Ontario mine up the Guard Road. The RFP would be to seek builders that could build housing for renters as low as 30% of AMI. Anything you particularly like about the project?
Well, its proximity to a significant portion of employers. That's really appealing up there. Trying to get traffic out of town is one of our, you know, primary goals in the community. And if some of those employers up there, I think we used a 0.5 or a mile radius from the site for an RFP. Ideally, what that does is it keeps workforce in the area, and those employers could potentially shuttle them to and from this particular location to places like the Montage or Stein Erickson's or Deer Valley, you name it. You know, there are a lot of options up there. If you drive up there, there's a significant amount of housing. There's a significant amount of workforce that is needed to keep that area running, and almost all of it has to come through town. So we're trying to move things around. This seems like a pretty good location for that, but the city council made pretty clear that, you know, the lion's share of the burden will have to land on those submitting for the RFP. We're not really interested in doing all the legwork that we do on a lot of our other projects up front. And we also have some community conversation to be had. That land was, you know, a part of the Flagstaff agreement. We had public input last night highlighting that they may want to come in and educate us on how important that piece of land was. So, you know, this isn't a done deal by any stretch of the imagination, but we want to explore all options to solve our housing crisis.
Yeah. What's it going to take to make that site work in terms of, I mean, would you need some kind of grocery store so that you keep people up there? I mean, we're going to need some good transit as well.
Well, transit is obviously always a part of the solution. In terms of amenities up there, I honestly, we haven't even scratched the surface of that conversation.
All right. Another discussion item was speed limits on city roads. Any in particular that we're talking about?
Any speed limits in particular?
Yeah, or roads. Maybe roads. Yeah.
You know, it was kind of a lively debate there. I really want to highlight that the community, well, the city has long been asking for the opportunity to have control over speed limits. We've worked with partner communities around the state. We've worked with our legislature, and, you know, we now have the capability to actually have some control over speed limits in our community, and we want to take advantage of that opportunity. In terms of what roads or what speeds, we did have a little bit of a robust debate on that last night. I think Jeremy and I landed on, you know, kind of a blanket 15 mile an hour speed limit to slow everybody down. When you roll into town, you know what the speed limit is. I think what we ended up with is we're going to allow for between option 2 and 3 that was presented to us, rather than just a blanket speed limit over the entire community. There will be some roads that are looked at and maybe are exceptions where, you know, 15 miles an hour might feel pretty slow. But Jeremy made good points. He said, I just don't see a downside to slowing everybody down kind of everywhere.
Well, and I'm just going to point out that 15 miles an hour, I mean, we'll have e-bikes going faster than vehicles. That's okay?
Maybe people will get out of their cars, which has been a mission of Park Cities for a long time. I mean, I personally believe that if you create a little bit of a pain point, people's behavior will change. If the pain point isn't enough, their behavior won't change. And as we know, living over in Prospector, we had robust public input from Woodside, Thanes Canyon, Payday Drive, a ton from Prospector. People use our neighborhoods as through streets. And I might add that if we lower the speed limits when a visitor comes to town and pulls up directions to get somewhere, it will always show them the route on the larger thoroughfares because those speed limits are higher. So this may have an impact on the community, which makes us feel like a little bit more of a livable community.
Just a couple of issues from Wednesday's retreat, the status of the Arts and Culture District. I mean, what have you heard from people? Do they still want it?
Well, I mean, that's going to be a part of the feasibility study, is asking that question. I think it's a bit of a hot button issue, right? Whether we want arts and culture in Park City. I think there's a lot of support for art and culture in Park City. Does Park City want to spend $100 million on an arts and culture district? No, they don't. We've heard that loud and clear. So to your question, somewhere between, yes, I like art and culture, but I don't want to spend $100 million. I think that's pretty much where we're going to land, and I don't know where.
But we are pretty convinced, though, that both Kimball and Sundance Institute are ready to be partners in all of this.
They've indicated that they're interested in being partners, and it was really encouraging to hear from our liaisons from the arts and culture area that both of those institutions were looking for the answer to that question you just asked, which is, does the community still support this area as an art and culture district? I think that that's fair. They should want that answer, and I look forward to hearing the results.
Yeah, and like you said, though, it's like every time people change, we can't change the plan. We've got to have a plan, and we're going to stick to it. I mean, how do you do that?
That's the question I asked at the retreat. You know, we can't change the fact that every 2 years there's going to be an election in Park City. Hopefully we can create some sort of a guide rail that keeps people on the path. But honestly, I don't know how we make a commitment that things will continue going forward other than going through the MPD process, you know, putting something in writing saying this is what we're going to do, this is how we're going to do it, and then start. And I think once you get started, the train starts moving and usually it can stay on the track.
And given the Homestake project, the Yarrow redevelopment and other major applications, of course, Snow Park and PEG, what do you think? It was brought up. Do we need a building moratorium?
I think we need to look at every tool that we possibly have to keep this train on the track and to use this area efficiently. I think it's a really important piece to what Park City is going to look like for the next 50-100 years. So I think what we do now really has a lot of impact. And, moratoriums can be pretty tricky. If that's a tool that we need to use, then I think that this council would be willing to do so, but we need to keep things moving forward. We can't just perseverate on all the what's and the ifs and the whens and all that.
So does that discussion come back at another time? I mean, or was that just an idea? I mean, does that come back for council discussion, whether or not we have a moratorium for six months?
Honestly, I don't know if there's a plan for that discussion to come back. I think what we're going to start with is that feasibility study of that area, get into the small area plan. Those things might, inform our general plan update. Somewhere in there, I imagine this conversation will continue. I look forward to having it. I think it's going to be, this is the opportunity that this council and the next council have to really have a big impact on the community. And I hope the community pays attention, comes out. I would love to hear the input from the community on what they want to see here, because we do need to start making some decisions.
Okay, Max, thanks for coming in.
Thanks so much. Have a good morning.
Park City Council Member Max Dorelny. You're listening to the Local News Hour on KPCW. Well, Park City Film has reopened back into the Jim Santee Auditorium for its fall series earlier this month. On the phone with a preview of some of the upcoming films, director Katie Wang, good morning.
Good morning, Leslie. Great to be here.
Yeah. So what does this fall's calendar look like?
Well, we just had a great opening weekend with Mrs. Harris Goes to Paris last weekend. Lots of new faces, some of our old patrons, but great to see people coming back to the movie and ready for more. So this weekend, we're really excited to be bringing in the film Marcel the Shell with Shoes On. And this is a film that was based on a short that premiered on YouTube a couple of years ago, and people just loved it. It was a viral sensation. And when it came to the Telluride Film Festival last year, people could not stop talking about it. And it's, of course, continued to endear audiences across the country. But it's basically a story about Marcel, who's an adorable little one-inch shell who lives with his grandmother and their pet lint, Alan, who is discovered by a documentary filmmaker in his Airbnb. And then, of course, he has to make a short film about him so that he can help reconnect with his long-lost family. So just a heartwarming, hilarious film about finding connections and beauty in unexpected places. So we thought this would be a great way to bring our community back together, young and old, back into the theater. So excited to be having that coming in this weekend. Then next week we're restarting our STEM education film series. And this is a series where we try to reach out to and connect with, the young people in our community who perhaps are from backgrounds that are traditionally underrepresented in the science fields, but certainly for all students, we want them to engage with the sciences. And we're bringing in the film called After Yang. It'll be a free screening on Thursday. This is a 2022 Sundance Film Festival film about an android named Yang, who's given to an adopted girl by her parents, one of whom is played by Colin Farrell, so that she can connect with and learn about her Chinese heritage. And when Yang malfunctions, the journey to repair him really raises questions about what defines a family, what does it mean to be human? So all of these kind of ethical implications about artificial intelligence. Like you, I grew up with the Jetsons. It seems like the futuristic world of the Jetsons is coming closer to reality now. But how close we are is kind of up for discussion. Certainly we're seeing a lot in films, but we'll have a post-film conversation with professors Elaine Weiss and Anna Moskowitz, who are professors in the School of Computing at the University of Utah, about ethics in computing, the future of AI, kind of how close we are to realizing that reality that you see in After Yang. So excited to be doing that. And then we kind of continue on with a great selection of films, some of which are from the 2022 Sundance Film Festival, and some, of course, are to get excited and get us all ramped up for winter. As we've seen, there's some snow in the mountains this week, so getting ready for that. But we'll have the film Fire of Love about French volcanologists, Katja and Maurice Kraft, who really just define the field of volcanology. I mean, I think in this community, we are all passionate and committed and adventurous folks. These people take it to the next level in terms of being on the side of live volcanoes and what they do there. Brian and Charles is a great film. Again, a little bit about artificial intelligence, but kind of a mockumentary. It's kind of kooky and very clever about a man named Brian in a small town in Wales who creates a friend for himself in the form of a robot, which is delightfully lo-fi and just really a story about friendship, family, finding love, and letting go. So kind of a Frankenstein meets Chitty Chitty Bang Bang type story, which is really fun. So again, kind of to look to engage our younger film lovers as well as our seasoned patrons who like to come out to see films.
Okay, and you haven't said goodbye to summer just yet because you are going to keep the Twilight Drive-In open, what, at least through early October?
Yes, so we've got three more screenings at the Twilight Drive-In, and the films we bring there at the end of the month, on September 30th, and kind of the beginning of October, we'll have Mountain Film on tour, and this is a collection of short films from the Telluride Mountain Film Festival. We're showing the Big Green World Collection, and this is a celebration of visionaries, innovators, and stewards of the natural world, so something we thought our community here would connect with as we love our outdoor environment so much. And then we're actually really excited, I mean, we're excited about all our films, of course, but on the 1st of October, we're showing the new documentary about Peekaboo Street, who probably needs no introduction in this community, but just iconic Olympian downhill ski racer. She'll be on site to help introduce the film, which we're really excited about. This is a film that premiered in the spring of last year, but has not been shown in our community yet. So really a way to celebrate our Olympic legacy and just the great athletes we have in our community. There'll be another short ski film called Brapski 2, Carl Falsfeld's film that'll accompany that. And then the following week, we're back with Matchstick Productions' new film on October 8th, their new ski film called Anywhere From Here. And just kind of that, our annual celebration of the beginning of ski season, just lots of hucking off of cliffs, skiing big mountains, celebrating that spirit of adventure and just the deep powder that we all love so much. Lots going on. And then that'll wrap up the drive-in for the season, which has been really fun, but a great way to kind of round things out and bring people back together. You can go to parkcityfilm.org, of course, to get more details on all the films and tickets in advance, but certainly we sell them at the door now as well. So encourage people to be spontaneous, round up your friends and family, come see some great films with us. It's exciting to be back and, again, seeing people in a full theater, eating lots of popcorn and laughing and commuting to get around the art of cinema.
Okay, and I know you've got coming up on a Monday with the Real Community Series. This is part of the leadership program, the film High Country. There's going to be a panel as well with both an author of the book and then the filmmaker itself.
That'll be on October 3rd. It's a Monday, as you said, at 7 o'clock. And this is a free screening that we're presenting in partnership with Leadership Park City about how the remote mountain town of Crested Butte, Colorado, has managed to maintain its character in the face of economic growth. So I think a story we can all relate to. If you've been to Crested Butte, it's stunningly beautiful and just has a great sense of self, which is something that we all appreciate and love. And the post-discussion will be the director, Connor Hagen, who's a Crested Butte native, author Paul Anderson, and I think his book is called The Town That Said Hell No. And then Miles Radiman, who's, of course, the founder of Leadership Park City, but also was the former city planner for Crested Butte. So he was there kind of in the, in the trenches when they were really faced with, you know, mining development, tourism growth, and just really, you know, was a part of that, telling that story. So that is a free screening. You can register in advance if you like, along with After Yang, which is also free. But certainly, you know, that just helps us know who's coming to the party so we can make more popcorn. But, you know, people can, of course, show up in advance as well, or on the night of, and get a seat. But that should be a really engaging conversation, I think very relevant and timely for our community here. So it's exciting to be able to bring back our free screenings, which have been on pause for a couple of years.
Okay. Anything else you wanted to mention?
Yeah, so showtimes for this weekend, tonight and tomorrow at 7, Sunday at 6. And then we also have a great dinner and a movie program that we're launching for the off-season, help incentivize people to get out and support our local businesses, get some free tickets to the movies. You can go to our website, each of the films. We'll have a link to the participating restaurants, but just a great way to get people out and about in a slower time of year. All the tourists mostly have gone home, so, you know, restaurants are still going. They still need us to be out there dining and recreating. So please take a look at that. But parkcityfilm.org for more information on all the films, special events, and the Twilight Drive-In. Put that on your calendar because it'll be a fun way to roll into ski season.
Okay, Katie, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Katie Wang is the executive director of Park City Film. You're listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW. News time now, 8:58. We've got 47 degrees currently here in Old Town Park City. Again, man, it's cleared up nicely. Looks like we're back to partly sunny skies today. Expected high today of about 64. Clear skies tonight, 43 is the overnight low. There is a 40 to 50% chance of a scattered shower, possibly a thunderstorm tomorrow, high of 68. All sunshine on Sunday, high of 73, and on Monday, a high of 74. Heber City reporting 51 degrees now, again with partly sunny skies in the forecast if there is not a rogue shower happening. Otherwise, looking for a high today of 73. Clear skies tonight, 37. Again, a 30 to 40% chance of a shower tomorrow. Otherwise, we're back to sunshine and 81 on Sunday and 83 on Monday. Again, a reminder, got lots going on this weekend. Of course, it's Autumn Aloft. Tomorrow and Sunday, 18 balloons registered to take off from the North 40 Field starting at 8 a.m. tomorrow. A candlestick event is going to happen here on Main Street, 8 p.m. on Saturday, featuring some balloon pilots, treating spectators to a visual display of balloon burners all set to music. And Hike for Hunger also happening Saturday, again, a great way to support the food pantry here in Park City. You can find out more by going to kpcw.org and searching the Hike for Hunger story. This is KPCW Park City. Stay tuned now. We've got NPR news coming up, followed by music throughout the day and football tonight. It's 9 o'clock. Have a great weekend.